Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. This week, we're joined by E.J. McMahon, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and its Empire Center for New York State Policy. McMahon joined the Manhattan Institute in 2000, founded the Institute's Empire Center in 2005. He has co-authored or authored major studies on public pension reform, collective bargaining, population migration, budget trends, and tax policy in New York. McMahon has also served as Deputy Commissioner in the State Department of Taxation and Finance and as a Vice Chancellor of the State University of New York. Earlier in his career, he was staff writer and columnist for the Albany Times-Union and the Knickerbocker News. Well, welcome, EJ. I'm so delighted that you're with us. You offer a great deal of balance to the commentary and what we hear around here from our various guests. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
EJ, tell us about what you think the condition of state government in New York is right now.
I'm inclined to respond to that by saying immediately, compared to what?
Well, compared to anything you would like to have it. Looking
well,
like.
Compared to what it ought to be, it's not good in the sense that I don't think it's been transformed or reformed in the way it fully needs to be. I think that it is better than it was a few years ago in the sense that it was, I think, dangerously adrift by the time Governor Patterson left office. But I think that right now it's, I think, kind of stuck in a not good place again, to put it mildly. But when Governor Cuomo took office, I think he did some things that needed doing in terms of he had to immediately reduce spending and balance a budget. And that task was complicated by the fact that the state had been relying on $6 billion in temporary federal funds that disappeared all at once as part of the so-called stimulus package. That was a challenge other governors and states faced at the same time. We had a lot of stimulus money in part because of our Medicaid program. And he did what needed doing at that point. Beyond belt tightening, I think that he fundamentally altered some of the levels of spending that were in place at that time. He continued to attrit away the size of the state workforce. I think it was a pretty good contract with the state's unions, all things considered. That will save money compared certainly to the previous contract. He capped school aid and he capped Medicaid. I think he's continuing to do some streamlining and consolidating and rationalizing of state government that was overdue on the agency level. But I think too many aspects of government in New York from the state on down have not been reformed to the extent they need to be in order to adjust to what is basically the new economic normal and to make the state more competitive.
So give us a couple of those that you think need to be done.
Well, I think the biggest example of unfinished business in New York is the area of mandate relief, which you often hear a lot of from local officials in both parties. And really, what mandate relief really boils down to, because so much of what local government does involves service delivery by individual government employees, it boils down to reform of collective bargaining and civil service laws, particularly that law we know as the Taylor Law, which is the law passed in 1967 that regulates and sets up collective bargaining between state and local governments and its unions. What happened was, in the wake of the recession, which, as we all know, followed sort of a bubbly boom, the problem is that while a private firm can adjust rather quickly to a fairly rapid change in its circumstances, a government can't. And that's not simply because government has to keep providing services. It's because the cost structure of government, particularly the wages and the benefits and the compensation levels set by employee contracts, are very inflexible and almost impervious to change. So you really have a deal, let's say, with your local police or your teachers that you really can't afford the way your revenues are now looking for the future. And meanwhile, you've been offering a wage and benefit package that's very generous compared to the norm for your region and for private sector workers, and you want to do something to change that. You're not in a position to do it. And basically what happens is you have to lay off workers in order to save money, which hurts local services and which can continue to feed a downward spiral in the case of many upstate cities. Now, the remedy for that is the mandate relief that's been backed for years, not just recently, by, for instance, the state's mayors upstate and down, Democrats and Republicans, would include things like reforms to the state's law that requires or that gives police and firefighter unions the ability to demand arbitration of their contracts. When they have a contract impasse and they can't reach an agreement, they can say, that's it, we want to have this arbitrated.
Isn't there an alternative? I'm sorry, EJ. Isn't the alternative to that letting them strike?
No. The alternative is not letting them strike. Strikes are illegal. They always have been. I think that that's how they would have you believe that the only alternative to arbitration is that they would strike. I would point out that police and fire unions are the only types of unions that have this arbitration clause. Others don't, and they don't strike. So police and fire would have you believe that they uniquely would have to strike if they didn't have the ability to effectively force agreements on taxpayers through arbitration. But I don't think it's true.
And what is this Triborough Amendment?
The Triborough Amendment was an amendment to the Taylor Law that was passed in 1982, notably 15 years after the Taylor Law passed, which says that all provisions of a contract must remain in effect after the contract has expired, including automatic pay increases. Now, what becomes significant there is that most public employees are on some form or another of a pay schedule. That is, as you progress up the pay schedule across pay grades, for each additional year you work, you get an automatic increase in your pay, quite aside from any contract-based pay. Teachers spend most of their careers, in some districts all of their careers, going up steps each and every year, and also can go across lanes, as they're called, so that if you achieve additional, say, for every 15 or 30 additional graduate credits, you also get a bump up in salary for that. What that means is you get an automatic pay increase of 2 to 4% a year, typically, each and every year, whether or not there's been an additional increase in the base pay in the contract. So when you read in your local newspaper, you know, Skodak teachers get 2% pay increase. Well, that 2% pay increase is in addition to the step increase. So what happens also in most cases when you hear that local teachers have accepted a one-year pay freeze, what often also is the case, or usually is the case, is that their base pay may have been frozen for a year, but they're still getting an automatic pay increase because they all got a year more seniority under their belts. That's very expensive. It costs school districts hundreds of millions of dollars a year, quite apart from any contract pay increases, to give automatic pay hikes. It also gives the lie to the syndrome you see around the state. You've driven around New York, say, in the summertime, and you'll see a lawn sign somewhere, and it says, you know, East Greenbush teachers, 379 days without a contract. And what that is meant to convey to you, if you're a local resident, is, isn't that terrible? Those poor teachers haven't had a contract in 379 days. I feel so badly for them. Well, actually, most of those teachers have been getting a pay increase since the contract expired, will still be getting pay increases in the future. What it also does is it creates a disincentive to bargain over needed changes in contracts when a union can basically just sit on the contract and get a pay increase, even if they're not willing to really talk about hard changes.
Now, is there any stomach in the legislature for changing this Triborough Amendment?
There's no stomach in the legislature for changing or touching anything related to a benefit to public employee unions.
Can you explain why that is?
Because the public employee unions are extremely powerful politically in the legislature, with both parties, are major political givers and major seen as important sources of political support in local campaigns, and basically legislators are afraid of them.
However, so it must be lonely for a guy like you out there.
Well, I mean, but the thing is, we have a tax cap in New York, which was stridently opposed by all the public employee unions, especially the most powerful union of all, the New York State United Teachers Union. What that showed was that there is a potential for change if the legislature is working with, or in this case, almost under the thumb of, a governor who wants to make change occur. The reason there's no change in Triborough, even though it's very strongly supported by school boards across the state, which, as you know, are non-political, and by mayors and county executives in both political parties across the state, the reason that doesn't happen is because Governor Cuomo will not make it a priority. When Governor Cuomo's asked, what about Triborough? He suddenly becomes very meek. You know that Governor Cuomo usually is very strong and assertive. When it comes to Triborough, he sits back and he says, oh, that's not going to happen. The legislature doesn't want to do that. Now, that sounds like an independent political pundit's appraisal of what will happen, not what a governor thinks will happen who wants it to happen. So basically what he's saying is he does not want to make it a priority.
So can I ask you this, following up on that? I've had a feeling for quite some time now, for a number of political reasons, that this governor can pretty much have whatever he wants. Is that right or wrong?
I don't think that's the case even with this governor. I would say that he is in a commanding position to get a lot of things that other governors have not been able to get. The tax cap, for instance, was one of them. I don't think Eliot Spitzer would have been able to get the same tax cap if none of his problems had occurred and had he pushed a tax cap. I think he has a good understanding of how to work his will in the legislature and how to leverage one thing against another. I think that he's in a better position to achieve some things, but has drawn a line short of wanting to actually burn up his capital. He's built up a huge store of political capital. He has, as you know, one of the highest approval ratings, even after recent reductions, one of the highest approval ratings in recorded history in New York. But if he got more things out of the legislature, for instance, if he decided he was going to make a fight over the mandate relief, the kind of mandate relief I'm talking about, which touches on collective bargaining and unions, they would hammer him. He would be the object of critical ads. You saw this a little bit during the pension debate last year, when before the legislature enacted what was really a rather mild pension reform affecting only new hires, the unions flooded the airwaves for about a week and a half with ads that were meant to make you believe that the governor and the legislature wanted to beat it up on your local firefighter or whoever was going to take you to the hospital in an ambulance or a teacher. And what that does is when you do a concerted ad campaign like that, it will bring down somebody's positive rating temporarily. And one can only assume that the governor doesn't have the taste for doing that on a prolonged basis. Now, I'll give you another example of an issue where he has a lot of leverage that actually fits into what you say almost. The arbitration law I was talking about, the law that gives police and firefighters around the state the ability to say, that's it, we don't want to negotiate, we want an arbitration. That law has been temporary since 1974. It's been reenacted every few years since 1974. And you may recall 1974 was a statewide election year. It was not a coincidence that it was enacted in a statewide election year to begin with. It next expires at the end of this coming June. Now, the way the dynamic between the governor and legislature works, the strongest position any governor can be in is when the legislature can't actually maintain a law unless he agrees to it. In other words, the governor doesn't have to propose a change in arbitration. He can simply sit back and do nothing.
Watch it sunset.
Watch it sunset. So at a certain point, they would come to him and say, what kind of extender are you willing to sign? Because there's a history in this state of governors, in fact, vetoing things that unions wanted, and the legislature doesn't override gubernatorial vetoes. There's also a precedent from 2009 when David Paterson vetoed what had always been a routine extender of a police pension plan for the cops in the state. Shocked people. The legislature didn't override him. So basically, if the governor did nothing and just played dumb, they'd be coming to him saying, well, what will it take for us to get this? Now, instead, what he did was, he has the clock working in his behalf, in other words. Well, what he did was he proposed a change to arbitration as part of his budget, even though it's not budget related. That, again, was kind of a mild, tepid change. It said that only distressed, if you're a distressed municipality, we'll cap the size of the settlement. And I think that considering the position he's in, he's in a commanding position here. I mean, he can kind of write his own ticket on that. However, and this is, we've already seen this to a certain extent, if he stood really firm and was really tough on this issue, he would take a beating. You would see police and fire unions run commercials around the state saying that Governor Cuomo wants to hurt your local firefighter and police. He's not grateful to us. Don't we deserve better? Now, most people don't understand the details of the issue. And even though most of the politicians in cities in particular, which benefit from this, Democrats and Republicans wanted and could help their local taxpayers if they had it, in the short term, the governor would take a political beating if he was in the forefront of an effort to change it. Apparently, he does not want to take that beating. And so, therefore, he tried to kind of circumvent any kind of real debate by putting something in the budget. Now, interestingly, the legislature was unwilling even to do that. In their version of the budget, they simply had a straight extension of the arbitration law with no change. The Republicans in the Senate and the Democrats in the Assembly did that. But the governor doesn't have to agree to that either. So I suspect now the issue will be with us until the end of session, and he has a chance to do better.
He wants to run for president, obviously, at least according to the way I see it. A lot of what you've been describing is that there are some sacred cows you really can't take on. I mean, how do you take on unions if you want the Democratic nomination?
Well, but he did take on unions when he did the tax cap, and he did take on the unions when he did the so-called Tier 6 pension changes. Now,
mm-hmm. Again, for the listeners, that means there's yet another tier. When I was working at SUNY, I had Tier 1. Now we're at Tier 6, which means you get less than the other guys used to get.
But you still get a lot more than anybody, I mean, you can retire with a much bigger guaranteed retirement benefit than anybody in the private sector can, or even the corporate sector.
Not anybody from Exxon or from the banks.
I beg your pardon? Other than the CEOs and
that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, well, I mean, other than the upper crust, there's nobody in the private sector who's got the kind of guaranteed income a typical public employee in most states get.
Okay.
But Tier 6, nonetheless, that was very controversial, and the unions were very unhappy about it. The property tax cap was controversial, and unions were unhappy about it. So in his first year, at least, first little over a year, 14 months in office, those things were not popular with
him. But E.J. McMahon, isn't that the way it always happens? Cuomo's papa did the same thing. He comes into office the first year. That's when you tighten things up. And then as you get closer to the election, to the reelection, that's when you get a little bit more liberal with the people's money.
Well, that's probably been the general pattern, yes. People get more liberal with people's money as they go further into election. That was the case with George Pataki as well in his fourth year after three tight years.
Sure.
And that probably will be the case this time, which doesn't augur well for next year, I guess.
Well, yes. I wanted to ask you something. I think it's fair to say, E.J. McMahon, that you're sort of at least center-right in your approach to government, don't you think?
That's probably not unfair, although I don't like to have it thought I'm totally predictable, but yeah.
No.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. Now, the state Senate used to be the bulwark for pro-business. You mentioned before, by the way, and you're quite right, that Norman Adler and his troops years and years and years ago decided they would put their money on the state Senate, which is why the unions have done so well with the state Senate, I think. But I wanted to ask you whether or not you feel that with the number of Democrats, elected Democrats, now outnumbering the number of Republicans, that things have substantially and formally changed.
Have things changed in New York? Since when?
Since the last election cycle. There's now one less Republican than Democrat. So in other words, now you have the independent Democratic Party, you have the regular Democratic Party, you add them all up, you got more votes than the Republicans, and stuff is getting to the floor. Stuff that would have been opposed by, I suspect, you and others of your group, getting to the floor because there has to be more compromise on the part of the Republican leadership.
Well, I mean, have things changed since the last election? Of course they have. I wouldn't say that. I think you'd have trouble finding some place where, first of all, I'm not partisan and I don't lobby issues. It's a think tank, so I don't take positions on whatever's on the floor. Secondly, if you were somebody who was trying to find some sort of consistent philosophical consistency to what the Senate has done under Republican leadership for something like 30 years, it could be quite a challenge.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think the Senate in New York, like you said, the phrase pro-business. Well, there's a difference, Milton Friedman once pointed out, between being pro-business and pro-free market. Mm-hmm. There's business is, there's a set of business lobbies that are interested in different things that are not always what the taxpayers are interested in or what's best for the free market. And I think the Senate, you know, over time has always, you know, I think the Senate has always viewed things, tended to view things rather in terms of interest groups and have identified themselves in their own mind politically as being with one interest group or another without thinking always in terms of what was best for the state.
I wanted to talk to you.
But that's not that they're not unique in that either. I think the assembly does left of center does the same thing.
EJ, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about campaign financing. Do you think that the public is in a mood to pay for political campaigns?
I don't think the public is in a mood to pay for political campaigns in general, and I don't think in New York State the public would be in the mood for something like New York City's system, which the governor has essentially embraced, if they understood what it was, because it involves a quite substantial overmatch of public funds.
What do you mean by overmatch?
Well, I mean it's like $5 or $6 per dollar raised in private contributions for a citywide candidate in New York. I don't think anybody would say New York's politics are marvelous, New York City's, because they have public campaign financing.
But let's face it, EJ, you're a big guy at the Manhattan Institute and the Empire Center, and many of your donors are, you know, basically guys who have a lot of money. So, you know, one could say, oh, EJ, you know, you're just sticking up for the rich guys and you don't want the common people to have an equal opportunity to fund campaigns.
I don't know if the common people have that much of an opportunity to fund campaigns anywhere. It's hard to know where to start with that. I don't have any linkage with any fundraising, with any campaign. I never have. I think that if you look again in New York City, if you're going to tell me that regular people fund campaigns in New York City, you're seeing something
through their tax dollars.
I mean, they do it through their tax dollars. That means you spend that a lot of your tax dollars go to people you would never on your own support. And I think that a lot of people are not interested in having their tax dollars go to fund the campaigns of people they strongly disagree with.
Okay. We only have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you about hydraulic fracturing, fracking. There's a huge movement opposed to it on different grounds in New York State. Do you have a different take?
Well, I mean, I think the weight of the evidence very much demonstrates that you can do shale gas exploration with hydrofracking. safely environmentally, that if it's properly regulated, it can be done in a way that is safe and productive. That's a whole long debate that's played out in this station and other places for years now, and so getting into the details of it at this point would be a little long, but I think that hydrofracking can go forward in a way that is environmentally safe and economically productive. Meanwhile, we see the economic numbers, especially in the region of the state that would benefit from shale gas exploration, are just awful. I mean, that the most of upstate New York, especially the southern tier, is flat on its back. There's basically nothing happening at all. There's no growth. Shale gas exploration represents a way to jumpstart some growth in that region. It's not the only way, but I think it would be, you know, I don't think that the weight of the scientific evidence is against shale gas exploration, which is why it's occurring essentially just about everywhere else it could occur except New York State.
Talk to me about pre-K education. You know, the governor says he wants to do pre-K for those who really need it the most. There are those, including me, who think it should go to every kid because we know it works. Your take?
I'm not sure the weight of the evidence proves that we know it works. I think that there's conflicting research on whether it actually works, and that in the cases where it does work, which is with poor kids, whether the effect is lasting, which points to another problem, which has to do with the middle school level on up. I haven't seen enough details of the governor's plan to know how carefully targeted it would be. I think if you had universal pre-K, you would be supplying a lot of free childcare for people who could afford to pay for it themselves, essentially, and who don't, in fact, need it as much as some other kids do. So I think the governor is right to the extent that he says that it should be targeted. I think that's correct. I don't think that it's a slam dunk case that it works, period, and that it's always worth it.
We've been talking to E.J. McMahon, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and its Empire Center for New York State Policy, a major player here in Albany. E.J., you're always welcome back before these microphones, and I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Alan.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org, and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decision to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.